International.
Ici Radio Canada. This is Canada.
This is Radio Nederland, the Dutch World Broadcasting System in Hilversum, Holland.
You're tuned to Swiss Radio International in Bern.
This is Free China as a presentation of the Voice of Free China, the international service of the Broadcasting Corporation of China.
This is Radio Havana, Cuba.
Broadcasting from Cuba, free territory in the Americas.
This is Radio South Africa.
This is Yugoslavia Radio Belgrade calling.
This is Israel broadcasting from Jerusalem.
This is Radio Pyongyang of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea.
This is the General Overseas Service of the BBC.
This is a group from Israel. They came in knowing there would be trouble. They tried to negotiate with the elders. They said they were giving them 2 hours, and something happened. They went in and immediately started firing with heavy weapons. We've seen mortars come this way. There's snipers in various houses, but they appear to be getting towards the center of town now.
That was slain U.S. journalist James Foley reporting from Syria. Hello, I'm Keith Powell, and welcome to Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio International. James Foley made headlines a while ago as he was slain by ISIS. A number of reporters have, and also Westerners have been slain by the group. Conflict zones are different from what they once were. There seems to be no more rules anymore. It's becoming increasingly difficult to find journalists who would, say, be willing to go into places like Syria due to the fact that big news organizations like the New York Times and others have very high insurance costs. So weighing that up with the fact that a journalist could be kidnapped and held at ransom always plays into the decision whether or not to send a journalist into a conflict zone. Freelance journalists are a little different. They will go into conflict zones and then sell their stories to different news organizations. Now, when a freelance journalist is held for ransom, let's say by a group like ISIS, who does the burden fall upon? Is it the reporter's home country, their family, friends, or the media outlets which are paying for the freelance stories? Well, this is a bit of a thorny issue, and is almost like a ball that's being bounced around from one side to the other. To take a look at this, we have this special report from Jonathan Holmes.
Phil Balboni of Global Post spent more than 2 years trying to find ways to liberate James Foley. At one stage, he was paying four or five people to scour the Turkish-Syrian border for any information about where Foley was. In the end, he located him, but he couldn't save him.
I've been walking this path for, you know, more than 2 years now, and, you know, it's been a personal anguish for me in ways that I could never have imagined, and difficult for my staff, difficult for my business, and I think we're still living with the aftermath of this.
Although Foley had worked for Global Post for some years, when he insisted on going to Aleppo to cover the Syrian civil war, he went as a freelance. Global Post bought some of his stories, but like most such new media enterprises, it's struggling to make a buck, and it had no legal obligation to Foley. Still, in Balboni's view, it had a moral one.
The interesting thing about the last several years is that a lot of young freelance journalists have gone to a lot of conflict zones because there have been so many changes in our industry with the kind of the economic downfall of much of journalism. There are not that many jobs, and certainly there isn't much foreign coverage. But these young journalists are not under anyone's control. Now, if you decide to take a story from a young journalist who's in Libya, Syria, Iraq, wherever it might be, Nigeria, Somalia, then you, I would argue, are taking on responsibility for that person and for what happens to that person. That was not happening.
And certainly British and American governments aren't taking responsibility either. John Cantley, who's a British freelance journalist, filed reports for many of Britain's biggest newspapers and television news channels. Taken hostage at the same time as Jim Foley, he's still alive, filing reports for Islamic State itself.
Now, I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, he's only doing this because he's a prisoner. He's got a gun at his head, and he's being forced to do this, right? Well, it's true. I am a prisoner. That I cannot deny. But seeing as I've been abandoned by my government, and my fate now lies in the hands of the Islamic State, I have nothing to lose.
Nicolas Henin has no complaints about his government. He's one of four French journalists freed in April last year by Islamic State. In exchange, it's widely believed, for a multi-million dollar ransom. It wasn't paid by Henin's family, and the French government says it doesn't pay ransoms. But someone did. And if the French taxpayer ultimately footed the bill, Nicolas Henin thinks that's just as it should be.
On one hand, we have the freedom of the press. That means that I don't have to ask the permission from my government if I want to go to Syria. I don't have to ask for anyone's permission to go to Syria, because there should be no place on earth out of reach for journalists. This is the basic of the freedom of the press. But on the other hand, you have the responsibility. And yes, even though it is my own decision to go to Syria or to go to any war, if I'm taken, then it's not my own problem. It becomes my country's problem, because my captors will use me to blackmail my country. And I will potentially jeopardize the position of my country because I've been taken. So when you're a journalist, you have to go everywhere, but knowing that if you are taken, it's not an individual problem, it becomes collective.
Most American reporters I spoke to thought that Henin was trying to have his cake and eat it too. For example, Shane Harris, a national security specialist who's currently in the Washington Bureau of the Daily Beast.
Well, I certainly agree that governments can't tell journalists where to go and what to cover, and they're not doing that in the United States. I mean, if you're a journalist who wants to take the risk of trying to get into Syria, that is your choice. I think the message that the government, the U.S. government, has sent is if you get captured, you know, good luck, you made the choice. It's not to say that the American government won't make an effort to try and get them home, and I absolutely think that it should, and I don't think that's a controversial point. But there is, I think, embedded in the policies a kind of agreement that if you're going to go do this as a journalist, you know, you're taking it at your own risk, and don't necessarily expect for the cavalry to be coming over the hill to get you. And journalists know that going in. You know, if I were covering the war in Syria and I were taken prisoner, I would have no expectation at all that the government would pay a ransom for me.
David Roeder is a Reuters columnist who is himself a former hostage, kidnapped by a Taliban warlord when he was working for the New York Times in Afghanistan. He was kept prisoner for months until he and his Afghan fixer managed to escape. Roeder reckons that Henin's attitude typifies a culture gap between the Anglo-Saxon nations and most Europeans.
I think French citizens or Danish citizens, you know, or Spanish citizens, there's an expectation in domestic politics in France that the government will pay a ransom and will help an individual who gets into trouble. The sort of American, British, you know, Australian political context is, you know, if you get yourself in one of these situations, it's primarily up to you and your family to solve it. There isn't a clamoring in the United States politically from the public for the U.S. government to start paying ransoms. Reuters did a poll right after the murder of Jim Foley, and still two-thirds of Americans said they oppose the U.S. government paying ransoms.
And yet, says Roeder, who worked closely with James Foley's family in trying to secure his release, it's not an open and shut issue.
Maybe for his sake and the sake of the other hostages that were killed, there should be a more open debate about the government in the United States paying these ransoms. The U.S. has spent hundreds of millions of dollars on the bombing campaign against ISIS. It would be millions of dollars to save some of these lives. I don't know the answer, but there is, I think, too much silence on this issue, and it would be much better for it to come out in the open. And if most Americans still oppose government ransoms, then, you know, I accept that. But I feel like given these deaths, it's worth having the debate.
Rukmini Kalimaki is a New York Times reporter whose meticulous research first exposed the fact that European governments or their proxies have paid more than $100 million in ransoms to al-Qaeda groups in Yemen and North Africa. But should they have done it?
It's really a problem from hell. There's no question that if you pay, you are perpetuating the problem. If nobody paid, we would not be sitting here having this conversation. At the same time, is it okay to let innocent people die in this most horrific of ways? I don't think I can watch another beheading video of a U.S. journalist. It's too horrible and too painful. And the impact on our reporting is quite real. We at the New York Times have not gone into the ISIS-controlled areas of Syria for years now. I don't think we didn't go in at any point in 2014 or, I believe, in most of 2013. And that impacts our coverage. You know, it impacts our ability to bring this story to the world.
And that's one consequence of Islamic State's hostage-taking that everyone agrees on. Here's David Roeder of Reuters.
I have not, you know, covered conflict since I was kidnapped. I'm very lucky to have made it home. It's important. I try to help others who do it. I try to advise them and support them. But I decided in my life I was lucky to be home, and I'd put through my family through enough. And so I've stopped doing that and try to contribute with other forms of journalism.
And Nicolas Hena.
Actually, there were two big crimes made by my captors. The first one is what they have made to me, to my cellmates, and to our families, because they caused a huge pain to, well, eventually hundreds of people. The second crime is that they emptied Syria of any foreign witness, both journalists and aid workers, because after this actual hunt for foreigners that the Islamic State did in all across Syria, we are now missing of first-hand independent account of this war. And this is the other crime, and probably the biggest, made by my captors. Sometimes people ask me, well, shall journalists go back to Syria, still go to Syria? And my answer is, I'm not allowed to answer this question. The only person able to answer this question is the person concerned, actually two persons concerned, the reporter himself and the editor. And the decision to go or not to Syria shall be the result of a very frank discussion between these two people, and whatever the answer is, this answer shall be respected because there are good grounds behind it.
I take it you're not going back.
At the moment, I'm not.
And that slightly equivocal answer is typical, says Rukmini Kalimaki, of many European journalists she knows.
I think the reality is that as an American journalist or as a British journalist going into these theaters, you face a disproportionate risk. In Africa, I used to work a lot with European colleagues, and they were much more cavalier about the risks that we are taking, perhaps because they know that their government would, in the end, rally to get them out. Whereas I know, if I'm taken, my family does not have the means, you know, to pay this. My government will not pay. And my options are then what? To try to run away or just wait? It's a pretty bleak prospect for Americans that are taken captive by these groups.
The bottom line, says Phil Balboni, is that these days, for war correspondents, there are no front lines, no rules, and no safe conduct.
Unfortunately, we've entered a period of history where warfare is not as we knew it in the Second World War or in Vietnam or even in the Iraq War, where you have masses of troops behind the front lines of which journalists can safely report a conflict. Now we have regional wars that spill across boundaries with front lines that are constantly shifting and where the danger for covering conflict is greater than it's ever been before, and where kidnapping of journalists has become a sport that is indulged in by the people who are creating these conflicts. And I think we're almost certain to see these issues arise again, no matter how careful anyone is likely to be. So I think it's important that the public think about this and that we have the right policies to secure the best result for families and people who unfortunately get into harm's way.
Jonathan Holmes reporting on who bears responsibility for freelance journalists held for ransom in conflict zones. You're listening to Media Network Plus, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. One thing that's always interesting to do is talk to reporters who, let's say, were posted in one city before they get posted somewhere else to find out what it was like. Well, the ABC's, that's the Australian Broadcasting Corporation's, Lisa Miller, who is the Washington correspondent, is being now posted to London. She's been in Washington for a number of years and just arrived after September the 11th, 2001. Elizabeth Jackson sat down with her to find out what it was like.
Once I got there, you felt the tension in Washington, the fighter jets, the F-16s circling over the city, the fact that people would talk about their experiences about September 11 and would visibly shake still talking about it. So you couldn't help but absorb that kind of fear. There was one episode that lasted for a month or so where we were warned that if there was a biochemical attack, that we should seal the windows with duct tape and plastic. And we went out to do that because most of America was emptying the shelves of hardware stores. There was just this constant feeling that something else was about to happen.
10 years later, on the anniversary, in fact, you filed this beautiful piece to CR. It needs a little backgrounding. This is the Colasandy family, whom you first met just 1 year after September 11, but you went back on the 10th anniversary to see how they were doing.
And she made a lot of friends.
No, some serious stuff like that. That's annoying.
And we met her advisor.
Another school day over, and Lauren and Cara Colasandy are sharing some quiet time with their mum, Kelly, in the kitchen of their West Village apartment.
Your sister's so cute.
Well, and she was with Marvin.
But soon there's homework to be done. And tonight, for Lauren, it involves another rehearsal.
Cynthia Marie Lise Connolly. James Lee Connor. Kevin Patrick Connors.
These are the names of people who died on 9/11. She'll read them on the anniversary and finish with the name of her dad.
And my father, Christopher Michael Colasanti.
Okay,
don't
rush
read
through
it so
that
slow.
Don't rush through that one.
Because you just sound
weird.
Can you
just do it again one more time?
Okay.
Chris Colasanti was a 33-year-old stockbroker who'd been with Cantor Fitzgerald for a decade before he went to work on September 11, 2001, and never came home. He left behind a shattered widow and two young children. Cara was five when he died.
As I leave the room, sometimes like the teachers will be like, everyone be nice to Cara, her dad died on 9/11, when it's close to the anniversary. I don't think that that's necessary, though. I mean, and they also often like pull me aside for chats, like, do you think you'll be okay? And the answer is always yes, and I always am okay. I don't cry.
I met them in 2002 at their home in Hoboken, New Jersey, when I was first working in the United States for the ABC.
This New Jersey commuter town lost more of its residents than any other last September, one out of every 1,000.
You know, just looking at the skyline every day and having, you know, these two massive twin buildings gone, it's such a, you know, just a constant reminder.
I don't, look at me. No, look at me. I don't want paint all over you. Lauren thinks if she doesn't look at me that, you know, I don't really stay.
Almost a decade on, and life has changed a bit. They've moved into Manhattan and can honestly say they're happy. They can even have a laugh when I play them the original story.
Look at all those pictures on
me. Look how big my forehead was.
I do.
Someone needs a nap.
No, look at me. I don't.
Hey, that's me.
Kelly Colasanti has spent the decade determined to bring up two happy daughters.
You know, I did. I was very worried, but they've probably been the easiest part. You know, easy and smart and kind, and yeah, they're happy. It's probably the conflicting, you know, two things of I'm proud and I'm sad that Chris didn't get to be here with them and me.
She never had much time for talk of war in Iraq and Afghanistan, and she wasn't moved when Osama bin Laden was killed, believing US intelligence failures were as much to blame for her husband's death as the Al-Qaeda leader himself.
Well, I was sleeping. I think it came out 10 or 11 o'clock here, and the girls were awake, and they each came into my room separately to tell me, which so it meant something to them, which kind of surprised me.
She turns 43 next month, and while she hasn't remarried, she has a feeling this anniversary, the 10th, is going to be an important turning point in her life.
I think I kind of said 10 years, you know, not that I'm going to, you know, give up grieving, but that would be a good number and the correct for myself and Chris. So I'm thinking it's going to be a turning point. I'm going to move forward in a different way, but time will tell, and you know.
It's not often in journalism we get to revisit places and people we've met before. Too often we breeze in and out of their lives, moving on to the next big story, leaving them behind. So it was a treat to track down Kelly and her daughters and discover the years had treated them well, that they all hold a sense of hope and excitement about the future and weren't derailed by such a devastating loss. This is Lisa Miller in New York for Correspondence Report.
It's true, isn't it, Lisa? You don't often get to go back and check in on people.
No, and sometimes it's just a matter of us being busy and moving on to big other stories. In fact, it took me almost all year to find Kelly and her family. I started the process 10 months before the anniversary by sending her a letter to the old address where I'd first met her. I then tried a whole lot of other ways, including social media and various support groups. But that letter over the 10 months made its way from redirected address to redirected address, and it finally landed in Kelly's hands, and she contacted me. That particular anniversary and meeting up with Kelly, I was very grateful to her because she actually came back into my life at a time when I was going through great sadness because we had all just lost some very close friends in the helicopter crash at the ABC, and we were all feeling grief and sadness, and Kelly put her arm around me and told me that things were going to be okay. And she was evidence of it, that here she was with these two daughters and she had found a way to find happiness again. It is all about the people that we are meeting, the places we get to go to, and the wonderful inspiration that they can offer us.
Were you inspired by Castro?
That was a funny story. In 2002, we went to Cuba for a foreign correspondent and we tried to track him down for days. And eventually we caught up with him at a trade show. Our producer, Vivian Altman, could speak Spanish. And so I remember my great effort for the interview that we had with the Cuban president was saying El Comandante and we are Australian. And that was about it. And then Vivian took over and we managed to get about six questions from him. I think I was so stunned at the time that we'd managed to find him and that he was going to speak to us that I have a photo from that era. I still look at it and think, did I really get that close to Castro?
You've filed stories, lots of stories about music, and you've travelled extensively throughout the US to experience all different genres of music.
I can't play it very well, though.
You even went to Memphis. Of course, you went to Memphis. And you met some pretty wild Elvis fans. Remember this?
Oh, yeah. I'm the best kind of dress in black. But I've been so long, I know the street
and never, ever back. While the Elvis industry churns on, those with personal memories count themselves lucky.
My son says, I'm still in love with Elvis. He says, his mother, if you don't quit acting like you're so in love with Elvis.
For Kay Wheeler, it's been the love of a lifetime.
Everybody loves Elvis. That's what this is all about.
She was the first president of his fan club and became one of a string of girlfriends.
I just turned the door and walked in. He was sitting there all by himself in the dressing room, you know, in front of a mirror, of course. And he saw me. I walked up and I just stood behind him, and he got up and he turned around and he walked over to me, and the nerve, and this has really happened, he runs his hand all the way down me like this, and he says, "Is that all you, baby?" And I said, and my heart's beating 1,000 miles an hour. Yes. It was unbelievable. And a lot of fun for a teenage girl, 17 years old.
That's a very funny story.
Isn't it delightful? Even a son saying, "Come on, Mum, let it go," decades and decades later. You know what else about that story, Elizabeth? It was one of those days where the rain clouds started coming in. We thought our filming was going to be ruined. We'd been at Graceland sort of walking through the place, and I still felt like I didn't quite have what I needed from that day of filming. And I noticed a woman crying while she was standing looking at the grave of Elvis, and I walked up to her when she came away from the grave and introduced myself, and here I was in Memphis in the US, and this woman says, "Oh, g'day love, I watch you on the television all the time." And she was from Australia, and she had come all the way just to go to Graceland, and it was so perfect. It just topped off the day for us.
Lisa Miller, it's been a delight. Thank you. It's been an extraordinary nearly 9 years for you in Washington. Thank you for all your excellent work. Good luck, and we will look forward to hearing from you from London.
Thanks, Elizabeth. Thanks.
Elizabeth Jackson speaking with the former Washington correspondent for ABC, Lisa Miller, who's now being posted to London. Well, let's now turn our attention to propagation and what we can expect over the next 7 days and what's been happening. Here's our propagation editor, Glenn Hauser.
Keith from IPS in Australia. The global HF propagation forecast through June 20th, normal at all latitudes. From Space Weather South Africa through June 20th, magnetic conditions quiet. Shortwave fadeouts unlikely. MUF unstable. From Met Office UK, the space weather forecast summary to June 20th, solar activity at low levels. 30% chance of M-class flares and R1 or R2 radio blackouts. Geomagnetic activity remaining generally quiet to unsettled. Peter Kohlmann, OK1 MGW in Prague, says the geomagnetic field will be quiet on June 17th to 21st and 28th to 30th. Quiet to unsettled June 22nd to 25th, July 3rd, 6th, 7th, and 8th. Quiet to active on June 26th and 27th and July 5th. Mostly quiet on July 1st and 2nd. Active to disturbed on July 4th. From SWPC in Boulder, generally quiet geomagnetic field conditions are expected through July 4th, with A and K indices of only 5 and 2, but surging July 5th to 25 and 5, and a lesser peak July 11th of 18 and 5. Solar flux to Binghamton 90, June 24th to 26th, peaking at 130 on July 8th to 10th. Extreme tropospheric ducting along the Texas and Mexico coasts the mornings of June 21st to 23rd are predicted by Bill Hepburn's maps. Also across the western Mediterranean on June 23rd and all week around Arabia. Frequent sporadic E openings across North America and Europe are expected into the VHF television and FM bands.
That's all we have time for. 73 and 88 to the ladies.